Accession number 11245, rear 3.
Mr. Goldsworthy, rear 3.
Right. As a watchkeeping officer, I had access to all the secret signals that were coming in, but there were was a special class of signal which I was not supposed to see. And one night the signalman brought round one of these without it being properly marked on the outside of the envelope. And I, of course, read it and realized that it was something that shouldn't have done. It was giving the position of the convoys which were moving for Operation Torch, the times expected of the landings, and so on. And so I resealed it and left a note for Commander Pike Knott saying that this had reached me and on the wrong category, and I was therefore sealing it up. He rang me at, I'd gone home back to the hotel to sleep, and he asked me to come down to the office, and he said, "I don't think I need to tell you this, but you must keep your mouth shut about what you've seen today." And I said, "Well, I don't think you need have told me that, but I won't anyway." And that was at a time when the harbour was filling up with all sorts of craft, and of course everybody was saying, you know, "What's up? Why are we all here?" And there were times, of course, when you're somebody in the know, and they know you're more in the know than most people, they're trying to find out of normal curiosity. And you just have to say, "Well, sorry, Tom, I haven't the slightest idea when what's up."
Can we go on now to when you moved over to Italy and the kind of work you did there with regard to Leghorn and so on?
They had prepared naval port parties to open the ports of Leghorn, Spezia and Genoa when they could be captured. And they were known as Party Howl, Party Item and Party Jig. I was to be attached to the Party Howl at Leghorn, and we went into to that port eventually when the Americans had cleared the Italians out. The Germans out. We went into a dreadfully battered town, appalling damage there, and immediately went to work on reopening the port, which had been closed with block ships at the two entrances to it. A curious thing happened while we were there. We had taken over the Constitutional Club on the front as Navy House, and we took over a pensione as our staff mess. And the Canadian salvage specialist who was in charge of the breaking through the block ships let it be known that a particular time, 6 o'clock in the evening, there would be an almighty explosion, because he was trying to blow a hole in the ships that were blocking one of the entrances. So we assembled on the balcony of Navy House, and in due course this explosion took place. And then, almost simultaneously, a mine went up in the middle of the harbour, and then the lighthouse at the northern end of the mole, which separated the two entrances, went up in a most God almighty explosion, which was completely unexpected. Fortunately, we had in fact considered whether it would be an ideal place to stand on the top of the lighthouse to take the pictures of the explosions, but fortunately we gave up that idea. So the mystery was, how had this come about? And we could only assume that the Germans had left some quantity of explosives there, which were likely to react to the explosions in the harbour. Now we went to the other end of the mole, where there was an identical lighthouse, and had a good look at that. And when we did the measurements, we found that in the measurements didn't tally. Inside the thing was a part of the lighthouse had been sealed up, and so well sealed up that you couldn't tell that there was another room there. Do you follow what I mean? And so obviously it looked as if there might be another booby trap there. So we decided that it would be dangerous to try and blow away into this. So they used what they call pepper and salt charges, little tiny bits of thing, and you push them into a crevice in the brickwork and retire to a safe distance, and they just go pop. And then you go back and release the odd brick, and then you do it again. And we finally got through, cleared the way through into this sealed off room, and there was nothing there, just nothing. So it's always been a mystery to me for this 40, 50 years since. And we can only guess that having laid the booby trap at the far end, the one lighthouse, they made the other lighthouse look similar in its dimensions, so that we wouldn't spot that there was something sealed up in the one that actually blew up. That was just a little bit of... anyway, we were again the subject of attack by Italian Tumen torpedoes there. Not this time Tumen torpedoes, but the Limpeteers. We knew that there were some of the Italian units were still working on the German side, who were in possession of the coastline down to within 30, 40 miles of Leghorn. And so we had the same sort of precautions of having sentries on the mole, throwing charges into the water, and patrol vessels outside. And one out on the end of the mole, we had three badge ABs, an old Navy term which means the three long service sailors, had a little sentry post, and their job was to throw out the charges every now and again, and hoping to catch any frogmen who happened to be trying to come through. And one night at early in the morning, one of them went out to throw his charge, and he heard a slight cough in the darkness. So he went and shook his mates, and they then got their guns and fired over the top, and three frogmen stood up, and he'd captured three of the swimming Limpeteers. I was shaken very vigorously from my sleep at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I went round with my jeep to find them. And there were these three men lined up against the wall. And we took them into Navy House and brought them before our naval officer in charge, who was a Captain McKenzie, a real old-school naval officer, very formal. She sat there. I always have a vision of it even now, sitting behind his desk there with his cap on as if he was conducting defaulters, and these three young men were paraded before him, stripped down to their combinations, and Peter MacDonald, the RNVR, who was the port security officer, had done a very good job of getting information about everybody who was working for the Germans on the Italian side. Because we, you see, after the split, after the armistice, their unit split up. Some just disappeared home. Some went to work for the Germans, stayed on and worked for the Germans. Others came over to us and became part of the units operating with us. And we, so he had a very good knowledge of who was on the German side. And so he brought one of these chaps before him and didn't even ask his name, just shuffled his pictures and looked at him and says, "You are Malacani. You were age of so-and-so, you were born so-and-so, your parents live in this town, you've been serving with the flotilla mass for so long completely, and the same with the other two." And the effect on their morale was totally devastating. They, of course, felt that we'd just simply been waiting for them. It was really a little bit of luck that we caught him. And it was Malacarne's rubber suit had been ruptured, and that caused him to cough a little bit, and that was that little cough that caught the ear of the sentry. Well, now they had come in towing sacks with flotation sacks, which contained the bombs that they were to use, and also overalls in which they were to walk out of the harbour, and they were going to hide up. We had no doubt we were going to hide up with Malacarne's parents in town. And so unfortunately, from our point of view, these floating bags had slipped away. They dropped the lines when they climbed onto the mole and were detected, and they went away on the tide, and we never did get those back. But what we learned from them was that when the next dark period of the moon, another of the unit called Pavoni was to come in bringing fresh equipment with them to be hidden in the ruins around the port, and then they were going to mount operations against shipping as and when they chose, because there was equipment each. I have pictures of this. Well, each bag contained underwater breathing equipment, rubber suit, a net to cover the head, and a bomb. And the bombs had a very intricate method of firing. They were not intended to fire immediately. They were intended to fire when the ship had already gone to sea. There was a vane at the end, and movement through the water would spin this vane, and that would activate the clock, and after a preset number of hours, the bomb would go up. That was the plan. And there was also a devilish device on it, which was a booby trap by which, while the bomb was held against the ship's side or against the bilge keel, the trigger of this would be held firmly in place. And when it had been put there, then they would withdraw a pin, so that if the bomb, after that pin was withdrawn, came out, a spring-loaded mechanism would fire the detonator and would kill the diver who was removing the bomb, as well as as well as sinking the ship. Anyway, we got these three, and they were kept apart for 3 days and interrogated very fully till they got all the information we could get out of them. And that left us with a problem. Mr. Pavoni was the man who was supposed to be coming down with the fresh supplies. And he was supposed to come down to the vicinity of the port, and these others were at a prearranged time, were to be there signalling the letter R with a flashlight. Now, the problem was, should we go down and sit on the beach and flash the letter R, we might do that night after night and get nowhere. We might also be that the letter R was a warning not to come in. And so eventually we decided we couldn't do it that way, but we did alert. Well, I had the ML crews in to give them the briefing of what might be expected, that somebody was coming again. And Peter MacDonald saw the Americans and talked to the people who were running the port guards there, and briefed them on it. And one of the things that the Italians themselves had told us was that if they had got ashore, their overalls would cover them completely as far as the rubber suit was concerned, except for the big rubber boots. And so if you saw anybody suspicious at all, you lifted his trouser leg, and if he got big rubber boots with big lace holes in him, you got the limpeteer. So the guards were told about this, and one morning one of them spotted a man behaving suspiciously, moving round the port, and called him over and lifted his trouser leg and kneed him very hard in the crutch, which was regarded with a great deal of annoyance by the chap. It was Mr. Pavoni. And on the beach, we found 10 sacks. He had done a fantastic thing of swimming in from the launch with 10 sacks, like a long string of barges behind him. And by the time he got to the beach, of course, his chums were not there to help him round, and he was exhausted, and he just couldn't cope with taking them into any hiding place, and so all he was doing was trying to get out of the port. And in each one of these 10 sacks contained 2 bombs and a complete equipment for making another attack. I know that I went round to the place where they were brought in, and I had 6 of these sacks in my jeep, taking them round to the bomb disposal office, and I've never driven quite so carefully and slowly in my life, with knowing that behind my back were 12 bombs all in ready to go, see. Anyway, that was the end of those efforts. And later, by the way, one of those chaps who was captured was working with Crabb and others over at the experimental station in Venice. It was that sort of strangely personal war. Well, the time went on, of course, in Leghorn, and I managed to get home for leave. I'd been away abroad for 2.5 years, and I was given a special priority to be flown home to get some leave, and then I was, on return, was attached to Party Howe, which was the Spezia party, and Party Jig, which was the Genoa one. That was the big one. They had been formed up, Party Zig. You notice, by the way, it was the 8, I and J. It was simply the sequence of the part. Nothing very mysterious about it. They'd been formed up in about October, in 1944, wait a moment. They had been formed, optimistically, in June 1944. But they were still waiting in Leghorn in the beginning of 1945. And when some progress was finally made, by the way, this was a very curious sort of party, because it was under the command of Commander Sammy Brooks, a very well-loved, bearded RN officer, and they were not going to sort of sit around in barracks and do nothing, so they in fact became a road-mending party and went up, did a lot of hard work along with the Americans and the Italians in getting the roads functioning around there. But once the situation improved to the point at which there was going to be some progress, I was in fact detailed to go to the headquarters of the 92nd Division, United States Army, and liaise from there with the Navy. And suddenly things began to pick up in the most extraordinary fashion. Our problem had been to worry about how we were going to get to Genoa, because there on the coastal road there were 90 corniches, 40 bridges, and half a dozen tunnels, any of which could be comparatively easily, be destroyed by the Germans as they retired. But in fact, as it emerged, they were by that time had simply lost morale, and they were just getting the hell out of it as quickly as they could. And they were the Germans were under attack from partisan groups and so on. So they never carried out a demolition program. Anyway, it was fascinating to see the flags on the map suddenly start moving forward in the most astonishing speed. And I was lucky in that I was then detached from the divisional headquarters after going up with the general, and went ahead with a Major Woolner, a London solicitor, who was a Marine Major wartime, and he and I with a driver and one Marine as our guard went off in a jeep as the first two British officers to go along the coast road and into Genoa. It was an unforgettable experience, because all the way along it was rather, you know, it was springtime and we were being pelted with roses and flowers and cheered along everywhere as we went through the villages, because we were among the first to be seen, and the Germans, of course, had retired into enclaves or got out altogether. I can always remember that there was one particular large bunch of roses, complete with thorns, arrived and hit our Marine driver in the face. And I may say that what his comments were totally unworthy of a liberator. Anyway, when we got down to Leghorn. To Genoa, we found, to our astonishment, that everything worked. The trams were running, the electricity was on, telephones even were working. The place had been battered from time to time, but there had been no sudden last-minute bombardment, as there had been in so many times, to drive it. And so we went, our mission, for Wilner and myself, was to, first of all, to find suitable accommodation for the Navy. And we had already spotted from town maps that there was a big block of apartments overlooking the harbour. So the first move was to go in and requisition this as the Navy headquarters. The other thing, of course, that we had to do was report on what the situation was in the port. We had special reasons to be interested because we had been involved in an attempt to cheat the Germans' efforts to block the port in the most successful fashion. Genoa Harbour consists of two harbours, with each with its gate to the sea, and a gateway between the old and the new harbours. Now, in Genoa was the former Italian liner Roma, which had been converted by the Italian Navy to an aircraft carrier and renamed the Aquila. When I say it had been converted, that's not quite true, because they never completed the job. Because the RAF put a bomb into the engine room and they had to abandon their efforts to convert it. Anyway, when we were reaching a point when we expected to take Genoa, there was a special problem arose, because it was a reasonable guess that the Germans would try to use the Aquila to block the gateway between the two ports. So whichever way you got it in from the sea, you would only have access to half the port instead of both, the whole of it. And the idea was to mount an operation to prevent the Aquila being moved into the blockship position. It was known, in fact, as Operation Toast. And because most of our diving experts had by that time gone back to work in the Northern Europe ports, we thought it was an ideal one for the Italians to do. So a human torpedo operation was mounted by the Italian Navy, and the idea was to go into the and sink the Aquila at its berth alongside before it could be moved into the blockship position. The crew who went on this operation reported back to us. It was an interesting experience, by the way, being involved in preparing this sort of operation, because we had to get as much knowledge as we possibly could about the situation.